That's neither. I know we're just going to do it.
Yeah. Morning. We're bringing the House Committee on Business and Labor to order. Good morning, Monday morning. We're going to start out with a work session on Senate Bill 574A, so I'll open that work session.
Mr. Chair and committee members, this measure was before you March 29th. It's the bill that requires a person who's providing restoration work on residential or small commercial structures that's following a disaster to have the appropriate license endorsement from the CCB. Directs the board to adopt rules for issuing this residential restoration contractor license endorsement in time to make endorsements available by January 1 of 2017. There are no amendments. The Senate vote was 29-0. There's no revenue and a minimal fiscal impact on the bill.
Great. If I could have Jim Dino come up.
It's hard for me to believe this isn't already required.
Thank you for being here. I think as we left the public hearing on this, there was one outstanding question for me, and that was specifically what a restoration company would be able to do in terms of performing work versus not having a construction contractor license through the board. So where that definition of what they can and can't do is, it seems the bill is clear, but anyway, I just thought maybe you could help clarify that for us this morning.
Sure. Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Jim Dino, the director of the Construction Contractors Board. Obviously, we're going to have to do some rulemaking to make things really definite and clear. But as I read the bill, the scope of work that they can do is very narrow. Basically, they can do three things: cleanup, debris removal, and board up services. The bill specifically states that they can't do anything that is of a demolition relating to the structure. So that says to me that anything that's built into the structure can't be removed by them. Debris is like furniture and clothing and stuff that's come down from the fire or whatever the disaster has been. So
thank you.
It's pretty clear that they cannot get into the structure of the building. Carpeting is something that they could remove but not replace because that requires a contractor's license. So, again, I think it's pretty narrow scope, but we will do some clarification through rule.
Because that is part of the structure.
Thank you. I just had one comment to that demolition of the structure versus a demolition of taking cabinets off the wall and sheetrock down and things like that are technically not structure but are components of the building, and if they're not, you know, the damage or the smoke damage, at what point do they become debris? And so I hope that rulemaking does put some clarity on that so that restoration companies aren't dismantling, you know, houses, interior components. And so I look forward to that rulemaking. But
yes, we will do that.
Mm-hmm. Other questions?
Escobel.
Representative Escobel, you have a question?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I interpret this, when you say structure, that means to me that everything that has to do with the structure of the home itself, and that includes the interior 2x4s, 2x6s, whatever it is, or exterior, but anything on that should be non-structural. Is that correct?
Chair Holby, Representative Escobel, yes, I believe that is correct.
Okay, thank you.
So with that comment, is sheetrock and cabinets, are they part of the structure?
I believe sheetrock is, yes. Cabinets, I would say no, because they're attached to
the structure. I have a problem with that. Yeah. That's not structural.
Oh, it can be.
Believe it or not.
Steel reinforced.
If my house is held up by sheetrock, I'm in trouble.
Yeah.
Well, that maybe depend on what kind of sheetrock.
Yeah, holds your stud straight sometimes.
Well, we know what kind of builder you are, Chair Holby.
any other right questions? I think we've identified. I think one of the things the committee is a little bit uneasy with is that structure, and what can a restoration company come in and start taking apart, interior components of the building.
That's good.
Which we would consider demolition. So is it demolition of the structure, meaning, as Representative Escobar would say, his definition is actually getting into the studs and the framework of the building as opposed to anything else?
Chair Holby, we will do our best to clarify this through rule.
Representative Widener.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have troubles if we're going to consider sheetrock structure, because it's just, you screw it to the wall. I've done garages. I've put up a lot of sheetrock. It's not a lot to it. It's not a structural thing to tear out. How many times has your kid in the house thrown a ball against the wall and put a hole in the sheetrock?
Yeah. Well, that's your opinion, but
it's interesting. My son had a situation where he had a basement flood, and it did substantial damage to, of course, the carpet and the sheetrock. And the demolition team removed the wet sheetrock, which was crumbly and worthless anyhow, but would not replace the sheetrock. Mm-hmm. Because they said that was outside their scope.
Construction.
Yeah.
Any other comments?
I think, Mr. Chair, if I may, I think one of the things, you have to remove the sheetrock lots of times to see what's happened behind it. So yes, when they're in there doing demolition, otherwise, if you're fighting mold issues and things like that, if they don't cut that open and look behind what's going on, you're not going to know.
But that would, Mr. Dino, wouldn't that be demolition and require a construction contractor's license?
Chair Holby, yes, it would. Yes, it would. In fact, sheetrock is structural, requires a permit and inspection to put it in. So we're really trying to get at here, what the sponsors of the bill, I believe, are trying to get at here is just the people who come in and clean after the disaster, period. Anything beyond that requires a contractor to do.
Representative Kimmer?
Some people have asked if we could take a little recess to visit for a second.
If we want to talk about this more, I'm comfortable putting it off.
Do you want to talk or put it off?
Just chat.
Chat. Can we chat for a moment, please?
We'll stand at ease.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Reconvene the House Committee on Business and Labor, and I'm going to close the work session on Senate Bill 574A. I'm going to open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 138A.
Mr. Chair and committee members, this measure allows a brew pub licensee to distribute malt beverage manufactured by the licensee to other premises under the same ownership, as well as for export. Increases the amount of malt beverage that the brew pub licensee can sell at wholesale and distribute to the OLC licensees from 5,000 barrels to 7,500 barrels. There are no amendments. Senate vote was 29-1, no revenue and no fiscal impact.
Great.
138.
So let's have up, is Matt here? Oh, he is. Danielle and A.W. Landwell? I don't know.
No idea. Oh, Art?
Art. We should put print legibly, it says, right here. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you very much for being here this morning. You could identify yourself for the record, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Matt Marquis representing Cascade Brewing today. I'll let Art speak to most of this, but I just a quick rundown of the bill. Currently today, if you are a brew pub, you can self-distribute your product if you produce less than 5,000 barrels. This bill makes a change to that to allow you to self-distribute up to 7,500 barrels. So we changed from production to actual what you can distribute. It also allows you to distribute to any of your own locations. So if you are like a McMinniman's where you have multiple locations across the state, this will allow you to self-distribute to your own locations. And then the only other thing in here really is to clarify that if you export out of the state, that would not fall underneath the limitation of the 7,500 barrels. With that, I'm going to turn it over to Art, let him speak about his business.
Thank you. Art Lawrence, hello.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I was in this room back behind us here 30 years ago as part of the craft brew legislation when the Widmer brothers, the McMinniman brothers, Dick Ponzi that did Bridgeport, and Fred Bowman and I started Portland Brewing. And we worked with Paul Romain 30-plus years ago to get our legislation that we have right now. And we're just going through another growing process and tweaking of the original legislation from years ago. And when we got the legislation in 85, we created two types of brewery licenses. One is for a brewery, because we had Weinhardt's in town at that time, and Widmer's didn't want, they wanted to do their own distribution, just like Weinhardt's did. So there was a limit of 10,000 barrels placed on a brewery. There was a second part of the license that was a brew pub. That was set up for those that wanted to sell beer on their own premise, but not do any delivery. During the last 30 years, we've had the brewery side went from 10,000 to 25,000 to 50 to 250, and now there's no limit on the Widmer and the big boys on how much they can go produce. Pardon me. On this side, on the brew pub side, it started out, like I said, zero distribution. Then it went to 500 barrels, and then it went to 1,000 barrels, and now it's at 5,000 barrels. So this is a natural progression of our industry as we have grown. Right now, 20% of the beer consumed in Oregon is brewed in Oregon. We're a nation's leader, and we're a nation's leader because of this law. And I want us to continue to be a nation's leader. I have three generations working in my business. I have a daughter and a granddaughter and myself. I've got a family that's lived in the state of Oregon for over 120 years. I want to maintain living here. All I want to do is two things: hire more people and pay more taxes. And that's what this bill is going to allow me to do. Thank you.
Thank you.
That's pretty simple.
Hi, Chair Holvey, members of the committee. For the record, Danelle Romain, representing the Oregon Beer and Wine Distributors Association, with my father in the back here. And we fully support the self-distribution changes in this bill, and I'm just here for questions, so thank you.
Thank you.
Questions?
Representative Barton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If memory serves, didn't we raise it to 5,000 in 2009? Is that correct?
Yes, you raised it, but with this limitation. It was total production, Representative Barton, was 5,000 barrels. Now we've tossed out the total production, and it says 7,500 barrels distributed in Oregon. So it doesn't count what I go to sell to my own places or like McMinimum's. The McMinniman boys are joint sponsors of this bill for us, and so they want to be able to deliver to more of their own pubs. And that's what this bill is going to allow us to do.
Follow up, please.
Follow up.
So this limit, this seems like a pretty drastic change, not in a bad way, but i.e. we will not be revisiting this issue for quite some time. How long before do you think we're putting this issue to bed? A decade? 2 decades?
Representative Barton, that's a very good question. I know that for my own needs, 7,500 barrels takes care of me for a long time. I'm 71 years old. I want to go till I'm 75, so I got another 4 years to get up to this limit. And I've got some plans of trying to go build another brewery in the next 3 to 5 years. And my friend's going, "What are you doing, you old timer? Get out of the business." But I want to go do one more time, roll the dice one more time.
It's going to be sour beer again?
It'll be sour beer. Yes, it will.
I can speak to that too, Rep. Barton. Danelle Romain, for the record. If you look at the OLCC data on this issue, there are not many brew pubs who are even close to even the 5,000 limit right now. I think it will be a long time before we have to revisit this issue, and most people who even get close to that are going through a distributor anyway, because it's just really not practical to distribute your own.
Representative Widener.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
guess my question is, why do we put a limit on it? I mean, if a business has to come here and beg every time they want to grow, isn't that a problem?
Representative Widener, I would agree with you. I just assume there be no limits. But this is what was negotiated at this time, and you have the opportunity to change it if you'd like.
Why was there questions? So what's the limit on a brewery as opposed to a brewery?
There is no limit on the brewery. It's unlimited.
And so what's the definition, or what's the difference between a brew pub and a brewery then?
A brewery can do their own distribution and have unlimited amount of production. They can have a pub on premise, mm-hmm. and they cannot sell, Jesse, you can correct me if I'm wrong on this, but I think it's 5 gallon minimum that they can sell out of their place. They can't do growlers, is that correct?
Yeah, well.
I'm talking to Jesse Sweet from the OLCC.
Well, he'll have to speak for himself.
Okay. But what the brew pub side of it can get a temporary sales license, a TSL. Breweries cannot go get a temporary sales license. And that's one of the big differences right now. It's also limited on the amount of production that it can go to for its own self-distribution.
Representative Widener.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So in essence, a brew pub, all they have to do is make a brewery, and they're fine.
But you can't do both.
So you can't.
You can't own
start
a brewery and a brew
business.
Pub. You go one or the other. And then it even gets more involved if you want to sell hard liquor in your brew pub. And to go do it in a brewery, you need to go get a winery license that allows you to do it. So there's ways to skirt around it. And maybe it's time to take a look at all of the brewery, brew pub legislation and laws and try to combine them into one law, then perhaps it would be easier for the commission to make rules and laws. It would certainly be easier for people to want to get into the business if there was just one set of rules and one way to do it.
Yeah.
Cho Holvey, I see somebody behind me who I think wants to comment on this and maybe the history on this issue. Do you mind if I switch places with him?
Well, I'll call up Jesse and him. Right after this panel's done. Is any other questions for this panel? Not seeing any. Thank you.
Thank you.
Lots of questions. If we could have Jesse and Paul Romaine come up.
So much controversy over beer.
So, gentlemen, you've heard I think Representative Widener ask a fundamental question about why there's a difference between what a brew pub licensee can do and a brewery can do.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Paul Romaine with the Romaine Group, and I'm here representing the Oregon Beer and Wine Distributors Association. Let me comment a little bit on this because, yes, I was around in the beginning. Not at the beginning of time, but the beginning of this legislation. This was an experiment because what happened was throughout the country, you really could only operate in certain areas of production of alcohol. And it stemmed from Prohibition, where you basically didn't want somebody controlling the product cradle to grave because of the abuses that came out of, in effect, pre-Prohibition, where breweries would control, price stuff low, get you addicted, and it was a bad deal. Oregon was the first state that really experimented with breaking it up, allowing somebody to produce and distribute or produce and retail, but not both. And then we started morphing around with that. We started playing around with that as people grew. It was okay for somebody to produce a little more and self-distribute. We started growing the business that way, and it worked very well. The problem is that the more you start growing it, the more you start running into the old issues that led to Prohibition in the first place. And that is the big brewers, in effect, controlling this stuff and using their pricing ability to control the market. And frankly, we've sort of run into that right now to some degree. A major brewer located in the Midwest, actually located in Belgium, has purchased a brewery here in the state of Oregon, a brew pub, and actually it's a brewery. They changed their license, and they are now operating. And that may or may not be good. We're not talking against that, but it is time to take a look at the license and see whether that's something we really want to allow, or whether there should be some production requirements on actually producing at the place where you're selling the product. What this is, what you're asked to do today by Mr. Lawrence, is simply just expand a little bit to take care of some initial problems that have come up. One of them is McMenamins wants to be able to distribute to their own network. That's great. They should be able to. When this law was passed and expanded in 2009, we put it as production. The OLCC does not really track production. They track distribution within the state. So we simply changed that and then increased it a little bit. Frankly, nobody's even close to it. Fort George Brewing Company actually was a brew pub. They were getting close to that amount. That was the reason we expanded it in the first place. I believe it was Fort George. Actually, it was one other, a different brewery down in Pelican Brewery. I think it was Pelican. Yeah. But basically, Fort George has become a brewery rather than a brew pub. And now they are actually distributing other people's products. Because once you reach up to a certain point in production and distribution, it's very uneconomical to distribute your own product outside of your own little market area. You need other things in that truck to take it a long distance. So it's sort of a natural progression. But again, all you're being asked to do in this bill is just tweak it a little bit to take care of some immediate issues. And then we need to talk about, Is it time to start putting maybe some limits on what you have to be able to do at that production facility before you can actually retail at that production facility? And maybe that's something we need to discuss. But this is a very limited bill, and it should go forward.
Representative Doherty?
So this is a bill about distribution, not necessarily about production.
Yes.
Thank you.
Representative Barreto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So how does this affect this brewery from the Midwest that purchased the brew pub here? This brew pub still has to fall underneath these rules.
Well, actually, this bill has nothing to do with the Midwest issue. That just is sort of cropped up with the hodgepodge of laws. The chair is, we go through this about every 2 years, where there, alcohol it's like Swiss cheese. You sort of see it, and there's a bunch of holes here and there, and you try and plug those holes. And everybody's trying to do two things at once that are almost counter to each other. One is encourage the growth of an industry. On the other hand, make sure the industry doesn't go crazy, because it is a substance that, you know, can cause some issues. So really all we're doing here is we're not affecting anything with a brewery in the Midwest. We're not affecting anything about what you have to produce at the facility. We're just saying that those folks who are in operation right now can continue, in effect, doing what they're already doing. And we're making it so that OLCC can actually track the matter. 5,000 barrels produced, they had no way of figuring out what they produced. And frankly, we in the state don't care what you ship out of state. In fact, it would be great if people shipped a ton of stuff out of state. That would be more business for us, for the state of Oregon. It's what's distributed within the state that you have more concern about.
Other questions?
Thank you.
Jesse, would you like to comment about the difference between brew pub and brewery, what they can do, why the difference is important?
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, firstly, I'd like to echo Mr. Romaine's comments on the bill. The bill itself, OLCC has no problems with the bill.
Yeah, introduce yourself.
Oh, I'm sorry. Jesse Sweet, policy analyst with OLCC, for the record. Regarding the difference between a brew pub and a brewery, in Oregon, we sell alcohol under a three-tier system, which prohibits the sale at both retail and wholesale by the same entity. That's the general rule. It is riddled with exceptions. Both the brew pub and the brewery license are what you might call hybrid licenses, in that they allow both retail and wholesale privileges. The primary difference is that the brew pub license trends much more towards the retail, and the brewery license trends much more towards the wholesale. So a few of those specific differences: a brew pub license can also hold an FCOM license, which allows the sale of distilled spirits. It can sell malt beverages produced by other brewers, in other words, guest taps. And the brew pub can also do growlers. The brewery license is allowed to have an ownership interest in a wholesaler, which is a big difference. That's prohibited by the brew pub. There's some other finer distinctions, including the ability to have special event licenses. And I'm happy to answer any questions on this particular matter.
So specifically about the special event license, so tell me, can a brewery have a special event license, and can a brew pub have the same special events license?
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, the brewery cannot hold a special events license, and the brew pub can.
And what's the reasoning for that?
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, again, I don't know that I can give a dissertation on the legislative history here, but I think the concept is that one of these licenses is more wholesale and the other is more retail. So what we're essentially saying right now under the current scheme to these brewers in Oregon is, you know, you need to make a choice. What do you want to look like? Do you want to be more of a local retail-focused operation, or do you want to be playing more in the distribution game?
Other questions? Not seeing any at the moment. Thank you. With that, I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 138 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 583. Could have probably done these both at the same time, but... Paul Romaine and Jesse Sweet.
You go ahead. You know, it's crazy. Yeah.
Again, for the record, Jesse Sweet, policy analyst with the OLCC. In the interim, the legislature formed a joint task force on OLCC. This task force studied the agency and the industry and considered concepts to modernize the regulation of alcoholic beverages. This bill was conceived during the task force, and it does three things. It allows the Brewery Public House increased self-distribution permits. This is actually duplicative of the bill we just heard. It allows a brewery public house license to also hold an off-premise license, and it changes the reporting requirements for businesses that ship directly to Oregon consumers. OLCC takes no official position on the bill. However, the agency is generally supportive of concepts that promote craft beverages and streamline requirements for industry and agency staff. I'd be happy to take any questions.
Questions? Thank you, Paul.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we support the bill. Representative Gordon, Beer and Wine Distributors Association. It was negotiated. It works well. The biggest provision, frankly, is the quarterly reporting rather than monthly reporting by shippers.
You're Paul Romaine for the record.
I am Paul Romaine for the record. Yes, sorry. I think I've been up here before, so I morphed into that. Sorry.
We know you, but... So this particular bill is more about streamlining?
Chair Holden.
What I understand.
I think that's a fair assessment, yes.
It is duplicative of 138, although I believe 138 has a little more detail.
Yes.
On self-distribution. So you could combine the two very easily, and but you want 138, the provisions of it in. Whichever bill you decide to pass out, you want 138 in it.
You want 138.
No, actually, I just assume it go away, but you want 138. Thank you.
Okay. Well, I appreciate your comments. Any other questions about that? With that, I'm going to close the public. Is there anybody else that wanted to testify on Senate Bill 583? Seeing any, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 583. And open a public hearing on Senate Bill 623.
Mr. Chair, committee members, this measure removes the restriction on OLCC from issuing a full on-premise sales license to a winery licensee if the winery licensee, or those having an interest in it, produces more than 200,000 gallons of wine or cider annually. There are no amendments. Senate vote was 29-0.
Thank you. Paul Romaine and Bill Cross.
Good morning, committee members. For the record, my name is not Paul Romaine. It is Bill Cross. Today I'm representing...
Move back away from the mic a little bit.
Today I'm representing Willamette Valley Vineyards, who requested this bill when we discovered last year that there's a statute that, when passed a few years ago, allowed breweries and wineries to be eligible for a full on-premise sales license, allowing them to sell beer, wine, distilled spirits. For unknown reasons, there is a cap currently on that, preventing wineries who produce 200,000 gallons a year or more from participating or being eligible for that full sales license. The bill simply eliminates that cap, and we ask for your support.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Paul Romaine. I am Paul Romaine. And I'm here representing the Oregon Beer and Wine Distributors Association. We worked with Mr. Cross on the bill. We're fine with it. Again, this sort of illustrates how alcohol law changes. When the caps were first put on about what you could do with the license, people were afraid of big wineries coming into the state and, in effect, taking over the market. And that really that's not the business model that seems to be followed out there. And really what's happened is the Oregon wineries have grown exponentially and are doing very, very well. And some of them are reaching this limit where they really need to continue operating the way they're operating, and the limit really is not necessary. It's sort of a different model with breweries right now, and again, that goes back to our earlier discussion where we probably should continue the discussion and figure out what the best policy is. But wineries really haven't followed the beer model, and we have no objection to removing the cap. Thank you.
Representative Evans.
Thank you, Chair Hovey. Just a real quick question. It's an obvious answer, but I want to make sure it's on the record. This will help wineries like Willamette Valley Vineyards and others to produce more over time.
Mr. Chair, Representative Evans, that is correct.
Mr. Chair, Representative Evans, I don't think it'll help them produce more, but it will help them sell more and actually make money in their restaurant operations, which are becoming an integral part of the winery, where people go to that premise. Willamette Valley Vineyards has a wonderful location and a great facility there, and we support what they're trying to do.
Thank you. Other questions? Representative Barreto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How many gallons are in a barrel? I mean, we got three bills here, you know, and they are a little bit confusing when we talked about breweries in the last two, and now we're talking about breweries again, except it's in gallons instead of barrels.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barreto, wine is measured in gallons. Beer is barrels, and a barrel of beer has 31 gallons in it. That's why when you say a keg of beer is like a half barrel, a pony keg is a quarter barrel, and this is what you learn after 31 years of representing
a corny.
Pardon?
How much is a corny?
I don't know that one. You've stumped me.
It's five.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Fagan.
Thank you, guys. So, Mr. Romaine, would it be true from your testimony to say that 99 barrels of beer on the wall would be a lot? Oh,
99 bottles would not be a lot. But 99 barrels would, it would be, you would get back into the issue of whether that is a, what kind of contractor is needed to take down that barrel.
There you go.
So, yes.
So a question.
Sheetrock involved.
Right. Right. So, is there a distinction in the
steel reinforced
laws in the winery venue between retail and wholesalers, as far as the amount of gallonage they can use and when they can self-distribute, when they can't?
Mr. Chair, not really. Wine laws develop differently than beer laws. It was funny. Wine was always viewed as sort of the immigrant drink for many years in the state, and it just sort of in the 60s started getting more and more popular. Beer was really the thing that we had in Prohibition, beer and distilled spirits. So wine laws developed very much differently. So you have some things in wine law that came in the 70s and that continued on that are totally different than with the beer.
I guess my question is, why would there be a difference between the two? Besides Prohibition history.
Mr. Chair, product is delivered differently. It's consumed differently. It's packaged differently. And wine tends to be probably a little higher priced. Some of the beer folks are now trying to produce beer that's up in that range. Actually, the person behind me, Art Lawrence, produces some wonderful beer that is priced like wine, some of it, and it's actually worth the price. But it's just a different product, and the law developed differently. You really don't want to start trying to mix the two. Same thing with distilled spirits. All three are taxed differently at the federal level, at the state level. They're all handled differently. There's literally different distributors. In a lot of places, you have people that distribute wine and spirits, but not beer, and then you have just beer-only distributors. It's the way the market grew up in the United States.
Thank you. Any other questions? Not seeing any.
It's very interesting.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks.
That'll close public hearing on Senate Bill 623 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 937.
Excuse me. This is a measure that prohibits the retail sale of powdered alcohol, limits wholesaling of granulated alcohol, except for scientific, industrial, manufacturing, and other purposes that are identified by the OLCC. There are no amendments. The Senate vote was 29-1. There's no revenue impact. There's no fiscal impact.
Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning, Mr. Chair. I'm Paul Romaine. I'm here representing the Oregon Beer and Wine Distributors Association in favor of Senate Bill 937. We actually asked the committee and the Senate to sort of help us save us from ourselves. Powdered alcohol is something that was just approved by the federal government for consumption. The problem with it is it's potentially so subject to abuse that it makes us very nervous having the product out there. It's very easy to conceal. It would come in a packet. You could dump it into some water or some other juice, be undetected. Very easy for a young person to bring it to school or anything, any place else. The OLCC right now, because it's a state-controlled system, they would have to list it, and they probably would not list it, so odds are it would not get for sale within the state. However, we don't know what the future will bring, and if it's just on the books, it's pretty clear it can't be listed. That would be great. It's a product that just is too many issues to allow for sale in the states, and we appreciate your vote yes on it. Many states have already banned it.
Thank you.
Including our neighbor to the north, Washington.
Questions?
I guess this kind of
asking for freedom earlier, and I'm just wondering, we're a state that legalized marijuana, and we're going to say no to powdered alcohol. I'm just trying to figure out why.
Okay, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I went to Berkeley in the 60s. Okay, understand that.
You're a good guy anyway.
Yeah, thank you.
I will be honest. I voted no on legalizing marijuana.
And I did too. But sometimes it's just best to kind of let this lie. It is different. Alcohol is different than marijuana. Bringing a joint to school, I hear it smells differently than other things.
Maybe. Just allegedly.
I hear. But it's something that with this alcohol, powdered alcohol, you could actually just drop it into a fruit juice.
Mr. Chair, may I follow up?
Are you a backpacker or something? Representative Widener.
No, if I don't have a motor on something, I'm not riding it or walking. So I guess my question is, I mean, it's like prohibition. Aren't people going to buy this online? They'll have it shipped here. They're going to get it out of Canada. I mean, it's going to be coming into the state, even if we prohibit it. I mean,
sometimes we need to be protected from our own. If it's commercially available out there, people will sell it. It will be out in the markets. It will be pushed. That's just the name of the game. Sometimes it may be better to let something remain not authorized for sale in the state. You're not criminalizing it. You're just saying we're not going to be selling it here. If somebody wants to get it someplace else and go through the hassle, we're not going to be able to stop them.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Widener. Follow up.
I guess, I mean, to me, I'm looking at getting ahead of it and have it go through the OLCC where it goes through the liquor stores and make it harder to get and tax it. But if otherwise people are going to go online and be ordering this stuff and bringing it into the state, we're not going to be able to control it that way.
Mr. Chair, Representative Widener, and I do pronounce your name correctly now.
Yes.
It's a policy choice for you, frankly. It's probably not going to be offered for sale for a long time in the state. OLCC will not probably list it. Again, from a distributor standpoint, a lot of times if we're given something to sell, we go out and we promote it. It's legal to sell it, and we promote it. We really don't want to be in that position. So we're asking for you to just reinforce what the OLCC is basically saying, is we're not going to allow this stuff to be sold in the state. We don't think a lot of people are going to be ordering it out of wherever you might be able to get it. I don't know. I mean, one of the arguments is you could, you know, take it backpacking with you. You can put a packet and take it backpacking with you. But, you know, now that we have legal other things, probably lighter to take the other stuff than it is to take.
Representative Doherty.
Yeah,
Excuse me.
It's good beef.
Fanfare. Representative Doherty.
Oh, wow. I was just ready
to
say.
Make the question as good as the intro.
I was just ready to say, on a serious note, on something like the powdered alcohol, I mean, you can say that, well, now we have a legalized marijuana, but it's a little different to put something in here as opposed to smoking a joint. So I think, on a serious note, this really has, I think, tremendous implications, especially for the under 21s, whether you take an athletic event, school, anything like this. And, you know, we want to discourage anyone under a certain age to drink, period. And I think this, and it will become faddish. And so I just think it's really ripe for a lot of problems, and would encourage you to vote for this bill.
Can we get Jesse? Do you mind coming up? Representative Barreto, question.
Yeah, I did. This powdered alcohol, thank you, Mr. Chair. This powdered alcohol, is it just like 100 proof? I mean, just straight alcohol that's.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barreto, no. When mixed properly, it could be the potency of a beer or wine. It depends just how much is in it. It can be made any way you want it.
I understand if you mix it, follow up. If you mix it into a drink, I understand that. But in the powdered form that it comes in, is it just basically powdered straight alcohol?
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm not sure if it's straight alcohol. The other problem with the powder is there are other ways to ingest powder. Mm-hmm. We just see so much potential for abuse with this stuff that it's one of those things where we're asking you to please save us from ourselves.
Representative Fagan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mostly just a comment. I definitely support banning this. I remember seeing this. This is an issue other state legislatures are dealing with. I remember seeing this pop up on kind of the NCSL list of issues. And I think it's kind of a fallacy to compare it to marijuana, because it's not like we're banning alcohol. We're banning what looks like a dangerous form of it. Like, I don't know what's going to come out of the Measure 91 committee. I'm assuming powdered marijuana, like, you know, being able to, like, grind it up and stick it. I mean,
edibles.
But the whole idea of this committee is that we're talking about what we do with portions, etc. I mean, first of all, they're two different drugs that have very different effects and overdose concerns, etc. But also in that committee, we're also talking about, you know, dosages in edibles and other things. And I think the reality is,
I'm listening to this.
You know, Oregonians obviously passed Measure 91, and so now we have to kind of decide how that's safe. This is, you know, us deciding as a policy choice that it's not safe to have alcohol in powdered form. So I think it's kind of it's awkward to try and compare the two.
Mr. Chair, Representative Fagan, we've had a lot of history dealing with alcohol. Actually, you've been through most of the history today. And we know there are problems with it, and we try little things to try and regulate here and there. This is the industry that's involved saying, please, don't do this. Don't go this route. And it's not a startup industry like you have with marijuana, where they're still experimenting. You may be coming back at some point and trying to deal with edibles. That's another story. I can get into that off record at some point. But this is a mature industry that's saying, please don't allow this form of the product. It's too difficult to control. Thanks.
Representative Nose, did you have a question down there?
No, sir.
Representative Widener.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess where I'm at, I mean, marijuana is federally illegal. Alcohol, the feds just said, or powdered alcohol, they just said it was okay and made it a state's right. And I'm thinking right now would be the time to jump on it and say, you know what, Jesse, you get it, and you're going to distribute it to your distributors. So that way we know it's being going through the proper channels, and we're taxing it, and we're doing everything and getting ahead of it. Ahead of time and limit the amount people can buy and put all the rules and everything in place. To me, that seems to make sense with the feds saying that it is legal. So, and I know the industry is going to disagree, because I'm surprised Mr. Perry hasn't came up, because I can see people walking into bars with their own powdered alcohol. So now my bar bill will stay real low, because I can just order a Coke and mix my own.
Mr. Chair, Representative Widener, all is well and good until the first kid brings it to school and puts it in a fruit juice of his friend or himself and does something weird. And then the industry's got to face the public basically saying, you hurt this person. And that's the thing that we don't like. So what we're saying is, look, help us just a little bit. OLCC is going to help us. We know that. But the system could change. You know, all of a sudden we could have private liquor sales sometime, OLCC out of it. Who knows what the system's going to be? We'd like to see something on the books that says this powder is just not going to be around.
So, Jesse, I know you didn't sign up to testify, and don't know whether you're for or against or neutral or none of the above. But has the OLCC looked at this powdered alcohol issue and looked around the country and have thought about
what kind of complications it would be for Oregon to sell powdered alcohol and how it would be distributed?
Yes, thank you. For the record, Jesse Sweet, policy analyst with OLCC. Chair Hovey, we have looked at this issue, and we do have some concerns. I made an error in my Senate testimony. I stated that we had refused to list this product previously. It was actually a concentrated liquid product that we refused to list because we had concerns with the product. I would also like to note that in terms of our statutory definitions, powdered alcohol is kind of an odd duck. It doesn't, I think the agency will make the argument that it qualifies as a distilled spirit, but it does not fit cleanly within that definition. So if the committee made a policy choice to allow powdered alcohol, I would suggest that we may want to look at cleaning up the definitions to make it explicit what we're talking about. Again, the agency, our official position is neutral, but we do have some concern with the safety of this product and its widespread availability.
Another question. So you're not comfortable with the definition in terms of regulating it, but you are comfortable with the definition in terms of prohibiting it?
Chair Holby, that's correct.
Thank you. Any other questions? Not seeing any.
Mr. Chair, if I could just comment on that one last point. I think what the OLCC is saying is that if the product is not made illegal, there's a question whether we in the distributors could actually go out and get the product and bring it in independent of the OLCC. And some entrepreneur is probably going to try that.
Thank you. That's a good point. Any other questions? Seeing none, thank you very much. Was there anybody else that wanted to testify on Senate Bill 937? Seeing none, I'll close public hearing on Senate Bill 937. We'll stand at ease for just a few moments. To reconvene the House Committee on Business and Labor. And with that, I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 937.
Chair Hovey, I move Senate Bill 937 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Barton moves Senate Bill 937 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion?
Mr. Chair, if you would like me to verbally say I'm a no on it. I will. I think this is something we should get ahead of the curve and have the OLCC regulate it. I think people are going to be ordering this online. It's going to be coming in to the state. College kids are very smart. I think if we were actually had our hands on it and controlled it ahead of time would be a better way to go. But I think we should be ahead of the curve on it. That's just where I'm at.
Thank you. Other questions, comments? Representative Esquivel.
Yes, Mr. Chair. I had to go and testify in another hearing, so I haven't been briefed on it yet. So,
Representative Evans.
I'll be a courtesy yes on this because I'm still thinking about the long-term ramifications of choosing one over the other.
Chair Holby, I'd like to withdraw my motion if the committee will allow it.
Representative Barton has requested to withdraw his motion on Senate Bill 937. Is there any objection to that? The purpose is just to allow some to have some further discussion. Seeing no objection, his motion is withdrawn. Let's try opening up a work session on Senate Bill 623.
Chair Holby, I move Senate Bill 623 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Barton moves Senate Bill 623A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion?
All right.
Brush your big mouth.
Matthew, can we have a vote? Roll call.
Representative Beretta?
Yes.
Representative Doherty?
Yes.
Representative Esquivel?
Aye.
Representative Evans?
Aye.
Representative Fagan?
Yes.
Representative Byrd?
Aye.
Representative House?
Aye.
Representative Widener?
Aye.
Vice Chair Barton?
Aye.
Vice Chair Gennemer?
Aye.
Chair Holby?
Aye. Senate Bill 623A, having received the votes, has passed. Representative Hurd, would you like to carry this bill?
Yes, sir.
With that, I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 623A. And, committee, I think we're going to adjourn at this point. So,
Mr. Chair,
do you want to move 13A? Or?
You didn't need 138A for 623 to work?
No, I did not.
Or 583.
So with that, I'll adjourn the House Committee on Business and Labor.
All right.